In this conversation, I chat with Ben Farinazzo. Ben is an Australia Day ambassador and passionate advocate for mental health, veterans, and the healing power of sport. You've probably come across Ben around the time of the Invictus Games, where he won gold medals in powerlifting and indoor rowing. Whilst winning gold medals is impressive in itself, it's Ben's journey that led to them that's amazing. Ben served in the Australian Defence Force, culminating in a tour to East Timor, where he experienced a trauma that's difficult to imagine. Years later, in the midst of a major breakdown, being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, Ben then broke his back and neck in a biking accident, as if his mental health challenges weren't enough. What I particularly loved about this chat with Ben was how he was able to shift his perspective on life through massively challenging circumstances. While the need for flexibility of mind was forced upon him, he embraced it and is a beautiful and humble human being because of it. I finished the conversation with Ben feeling grounded and grateful. I hope it has the same effect on you. Enjoy. This is David Hobart from Beyond the Obvious, the podcast in search of unexpected insights for investment professionals. Ben, thanks so much for taking the time to have a chat today. It's really great to catch up.
Bloody awesome catching up with you too, Dave.
Yeah, perfect. Ben, maybe to start our conversation today, I mean, you've had such an interesting and varied background, you know, without giving the full War and Peace version, it would be great to sort of get a sense of where you've come from and where you are today.
Yeah, look, graduated from the Southport School in 90, went to the Defence Forces, was there for about a decade. The highlight of my career was deploying in the International Force in East Timor in 99. And then I went and had a civilian career over the next decade or so, ended up doing a couple of CEO roles. Then I got really ill with mental health issues and broke my neck and back, which made me rethink my whole life.
Well, I probably shouldn't laugh at that point, Ben. If something's going to cause you to sit back and revisit or rethink your life, that's probably it. So, just sort of, if you're willing to talk about it, firstly, your mental health issues that you had at the time. What was that kind of origins, and what was that experience like in a nutshell?
Well, when I came back from my deployment in East Timor in 99, although my boots were back on Australian soil, my mind was still somewhere else. I didn't understand what was happening to me at the time. Over the course of the next decade, I noticed my behaviours changing, went and sought help. At that time, there wasn't a great deal of awareness about mental health, and I definitely didn't think that I had a mental health problem. I just thought it might have been a case of work-life balance. It then culminated with me just wanting to get away. Thoughts escalated and it reached a point where I was no longer able to care for myself. I was, you know, drinking too much, smoking too much, doing no exercise, and my world was just falling apart. Ended up having to go into hospital. My wife took me into hospital because I was no longer able to talk. I thought I'd be in there for a weekend and ended up being there all in all for about a year, just trying to regain connection with the world and be able to get back home again.
Yeah, I mean, that's not something that I can easily get my head around. I mean, can we take a step back from that? So here you were going into East Timor as a what rank were you in the military at that time?
So I was a captain in the army.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, you, as a personality at that time, you know, who were you? Like, how did you look? How did you occur to others going into that experience?
Yeah, 6'2", army infantry officer. There was a highlight of my career. It was terrific. You know, parachute trained, bulletproof, young guy in early 20s. It was terrific. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
So full of confidence and, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Look, totally trained. There was everything I'd done in my life had lived up to that point. I felt totally trained and prepared, ready to go. I just didn't realise that it would have a psychological impact on me in the way that it did. But as soon as I got home, my wife noticed that I was a different person straight away.
Yeah, right. So that's a classic PTSD experience. And it kind of manifested over a number of years.
Yeah.
And how did you you don't have to go into the specifics of treatment or what have you, but like, what's the experience of PTSD like for, us, the majority of the population that doesn't have to experience the trauma that you obviously went through? Like, how does PTSD occur?
Good question. I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, so I can't really explain how it occurs.
Well, sorry, what was your experience like?
PTSD affects people in many different ways. In my experience, I saw trauma, but I didn't realise that trauma. In my case, it was a massacre of women and children inside a church. And basically they rallied into a church and the church was burnt down with them inside. And I saw the aftermath of that. Yeah, it was disturbing at the time, but I didn't really think it would have such an impact on me. However, over time, that and the events associated with that kind of just started eating away at me. I remember when I first got diagnosed with PTSD by my doctor, I said, that'll be all right. I'll just treat it like a broken arm and look after it. And she said, no, Ben, it's more like cancer. It's insidious. It'll eat away at you. If you do not treat this thing, it'll kill you. And she was right. So over time, just gradually, I couldn't sleep anymore. So I used to, probably drink too much to get myself to sleep. My emotional regulation wasn't there. I had to work really hard at regulating my emotions, which then made me even more tired. But I was unaware of what was happening with me at the time. I just thought perhaps I was working too hard, or it's just because we had, three new kids. I'd left. I was, looking for different types of employment overseas. So it was a busy time. And I just put it down to those factors. But it reached a point. Eventually I got diagnosed with PTSD, anxiety and depression, which is a lovely little cocktail combo to have. But my reality felt like it was just falling apart, which sounds hard to explain, but things in the world didn't make sense anymore. I felt totally disconnected emotionally from everything around me, which is hard to do when you're a husband and a father.
Yeah, sure.
And you're a CEO of an organisation, and I had to keep pushing through that and spent a lot of time looking for ways to address that and to improve it. And it wasn't like that all the time. It'd come and go in waves. And I thought I was doing okay in managing it, but then it reached a point where I couldn't manage it by myself anymore and I had to reach out to a doctor.
Yeah, sure.
So what the hell is happening?
Yeah. I don't think we need to sort of go through what the treatment looked like, but, where are you now, Ben, in relation to, the management of PTSD? Like how is your daily life occur now compared to what it did when you first were confronted with the conniptions associated with it?
Identifying it and calling it out was the first step. Which then provided a bit of a framework for how to address it. Following that was then a case of acceptance, because although I'd been diagnosed, if someone tells you a problem, tells me a problem at work, I'm the first one to go on, see who else has solved it and how to solve it and Google it and all the rest of it. You reckon if someone diagnoses you with a mental health problem, you do the same? No, I just avoided it for years. Yeah, well. I was like, that'll get better by itself, apparently. And it didn't, because I hadn't accepted it. So once I accepted it, then the real learnings took place. And I remember it was actually a padre at the hospital who came and saw me, and I tried really hard to avoid him because I didn't want to get into some theological discussion. But he called me up And it was one of the best conversations I had. He said, look, I noticed that you really love, you know, going to the gym every day while you're at the hospital. You love doing, you know, the sessions and all that. And you really seem to be pushing yourself. And I said, yeah, because I want to conquer this thing. He said, and have you been like this your whole life? I said, oh, yeah, if there's a problem or there's a challenge, you know, I'll go for it. And he goes, and how's that been working for you? I said, oh, what do you mean? He said, what if you're never able to conquer this thing, this mental health issue? And it kind of threw me into the void. It threw me into this space where I had no answer. And he continued and said, what if you saw your life as a learning process and every day was an opportunity to wake up and to learn more about yourself, the world around you, and the relationship that you have with the world around you? How would that be? And I felt this wave come through me of, oh, my goodness, that's such a wonderful way of looking at life and the world, just embracing curiosity and learning every day and saying, well, every day is a new opportunity to learn something about myself, others, and the world around me. That's brilliant. And I think that changed the way that I approached life from that point on.
Interesting. So Ben, as you talk there, you sound very different to what I imagine was a 20-somethings captain. 10-foot tall and bulletproof and trained and confident. Going into
I still like to think of myself as that day.
I'm sure. Don't we all?
No.
Don't we all?
Except until I look
that's
in
right,
the mirror.
That's right.
Yeah.
Hang on. I would have sworn I had hair. I don't know what happened. So you sound now, Ben, like I don't know, like you've connected with some sense of mystery in the world or of the world that you perhaps weren't connected to previously. Can you describe, you know, how you view the world today? I mean, you sort of captured it in what you said, but like, you know, on a day-to-day now, like, you know, you sound like you have measure and perspective, which perhaps, you know, you didn't have as a 20-something-year-old like the rest of us. How does life occur to you today?
Yeah, I think the first thing was embracing my imperfections as a human being. Just realize I'm just a man, just trying to do my best, and if I can do the best to look after myself, then other people don't need to. And then focusing on what's important, which for me is my wife and my kids. And then if I've got capacity beyond that, than to reach out and help others so that they perhaps can avoid some of the pitfalls that I've fell into or to make their lives more joyful. So with that, every day is an opportunity to try new things like pineapple on pizza.
that's a good day, pineapple on pizza.
Or to get out and, try to do some artwork, do some photography, speak to people, connect with people who I previously wouldn't have connected with because, you know, they were doing things in totally different circles. But breaking down those systems, those barriers, those walls, those perceived external expectations and just connecting with people as people, regardless of, rank or position. Regardless of who they are, where they do, just leveling out and enjoying just the experience of being alive, because it really hit me hard that here I was for so many years thinking about taking my own life, and as I was moving through that, had my bike accident and broke my neck and back, and my life was almost taken away from me. And being in that position for so long, it wasn't a it wasn't a sudden experience. It was over many years, that experience, and I think it embedded within me a sense that the world is an adventure, and I don't have long. I don't know when it's going to end. So I think one of the, to go back to your earlier question, Dave, one of the things that has popped into my mind is I ventured out into life as an optimistic, enthusiastic kid who wanted to see the good in life. And I worked my guts out and worked really hard to do my best and to be the best. This whole experience has taught me a couple of things. The first was that there's not just all good in the world, if we were to make a judgment call. There's bad things that happen in the world, bad things that happen to good people for no reason at all. And this whole experience has taught me to learn to reconcile that things happen in the world. The world is just what it is. There are shades of light and dark out in the world. It's also taught me to measure what it means to be the best and to strive just to do my best within my capacity, but for me to be the judge of my own performance, not as an external measure against anything or anyone else. Not to put myself in that sort of position where I'm going, what are they doing, what's happening there, and to measure myself by that, but to be quite content with how I've gone based on, you know, self-reflection.
Ben,
it might be, for example, like going for, yep.
Oh, no, I'm just having flashbacks. I'm having an image come into my mind, and I don't know how old you were when I first became aware of you, because, you know, we both went to the same school and I was a couple of years older from memory. I just remember, you're more mature. Yeah. Yeah. That's
got
it.
More hair.
Well, then I'm definitely older. I just remember you as a kid. I just have this image of you in my mind as this, like, with this white smile that was just so infectious. It's a beautiful image, actually. Like, you just, I think I've captured you in my mind before life got significant. And I just see this kid who has awe and wonder in his eyes and, you know, enormous curiosity and a capacity for engaging and adventure and just because you just a natural curiosity. And I'm not sure what happened. Like, it happened to me at school at the same time where there was a moment in my life where I got really significant, you know, like suddenly life was about achievement, life was about all that. Yeah. And I'm wondering whether this experience for you, you know, it's a protracted experience over the last 10 to 15 years, whether it's caused you to reconnect with that little bit of whimsy, that kid that's just got the smile and wonder again. It sounds like you have, like there's, you know, your voice is capturing that. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, look, I think it's always been there. I think part of the fear, though, is if you let that out, you're allowing yourself to be vulnerable and not be taken serious, and that you're opening yourself up to any potential threat. And this is what, you know, happens in my mind with the whole PTSD and the like. I had to learn to realise that wasn't the case, and that the first step in my recovery was having that courage to be vulnerable and to let that out. And, of course, doing that initially in a safe space before then broadening it out to, you know, beyond my family, to the community and the country and the world. So it was a gradual process, but realising now that, you know, I can play with life with a childlike mind, but also have the depth behind it to do the things that I need to do. And that to, I guess, that protect that inner child.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I see your public interactions these days and they're light. They've got lightness to them. Even though you're dealing in subjects that to a lot of people are heavy and are hard, your interactions are light.
Yeah.
And it almost occurs to me that you don't have an attachment, like your outcomes on how you're perceived and how suddenly, you know, you're expressing a sense of freedom in the way you communicate. And I don't know if you feel that, but it's how it occurs to me. Like, you know, you're sort of like, who cares? I've got something to offer. I'm free. There's no has to be a certain way, has to look a certain way. You know, you just seem to be able to engage in the world, yeah, with a genuine sense of contribution, nothing in return, no expectation. And, you know, you occur as free. I don't know if that's your experience, but that's how you occur to me when I observe you communicating publicly.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that observation, mate. Look, I'm very grateful, A, to still be alive, but also to have the opportunity to have a voice in the community through my various relationships with not-for-profit organisations. Part of learning how to manage that was to free myself of any expectations. When I master go and talk, I don't prepare my talk in detail. You know, I used to go through so much preparation. I don't do that anymore. I just think, okay, just reconnect. Stay open. Be connected with the room and the people around you. And just share what you want to say authentically. And don't look for the answers. Don't look for the instant gratifying feedback. Just say what your experience is. I'm sure there's some people in there who think it's bullshit. I'm sure there's others that'll connect with or never say anything. And that's okay. And I figure if people don't, but doing it in a way that's also armed with respect and dignity. So, I mean, lives are important. People's thoughts are important. So I don't go in there tossing around ideas and thoughts in a flimsical sort of way. Because people are important. You know, when you're talking about killing yourself and, you know, what happens, that thought process leading up to, you know, where you want to end your life. Yeah, you could go really dark and the like, and I remember trying to work out how to best express it, and I went and spoke to the Lifeline team and said, look, there's all these things that how you're supposed to talk about suicide, and I don't know if I'm using the right words. And, again, trying to look at external expectations. And the team said, Ben, it's your experience. You use your own words. I'm like, okay. So I literally go up to audiences and say, yeah, I don't talk about, you know, I was thinking about suicide and that might be important for other people to use those terms. I just, like, in my mind, I was wanting to kill myself. That's what I was thinking. How am I going to do this? What's the best way I can do this and still leave my family intact?
Yeah.
Sounds kind of weird. But this is the irrational thought processes that happen in that space. And I want to be just authentic with it. I want to do it with respect. But I also recognise that there's a time and place and people no longer find value in me sharing that, no longer ask me to come and share, and I'll be able to mow my lawn and get back to my artwork. but I've been quite surprised that it has continued and there seems to be a demand in it. And I don't know. That's the only way I can measure anything is that people keep asking for those messages to be shared. Because you can imagine after a conversation with a few hundred people, not many people put their hands up at the end and don't know how to ask the questions. So obviously, so sometimes I just have to flick it around and ask them questions in a coaching-like structure, because it takes people into a different space where they start thinking about their own lives outside of the day-to-day. I mean, if I was talking about how to construct an Excel spreadsheet, I'd get a million questions. Or how to balance P&L, you know, it'd be, yeah, fine, you know. Or ratios on the balance sheet, yeah, lots of questions. But, yeah, when it comes to talking about those deeper topics and being rather than the doing, then I don't think as a culture we are that good at expressing or connecting at that level.
So, Ben, how, yes. Speaking of which, like in your kind of recovery process, how much has meaning, like you finding meaning or defining meaning for yourself and for your life, played a part in your, you know, rebalancing, so to speak? Like, have you had much thinking or interrogation in and around that? Like,
oh, interrogation is probably a good word. Look, very clearly when I was in hospital with a mental health condition, I had a full body cast and was unable to move because I, you know, broken neck and back. I couldn't feed myself, couldn't wipe my own butt.
So you could do some thinking.
I had a little bit of time to think. And I remember stripping everything back layer by layer and saying, okay, well, why would I want to live? And then going, why? Okay, and then I'll go, well, it's this. Okay, what if that wasn't there? Okay, what if that wasn't there? Okay, I want to live because of my family. Okay, but what if, you know, they weren't there? And then stripping all the way back down. And I hit a base point where I thought, well, it just came down to sheer curiosity. Well, what would happen if I wake up tomorrow? Let me just see what happens.
Wow.
Let's just see what we can do. Let's see if you can learn to walk again and lift your arms again. And let's just see if you can feed yourself. But it was stripped all the way down. I just had to learn to breathe again. It was just learning to breathe. That was the common denominator. I thought, if I can just breathe by myself, then that's okay. That's good. And it was just breath by breath and concentrating on the breath. And then that eventually became an unconscious action of breathing and then learning to walk. And all of a sudden you start. I was very careful about what I let become unconscious. So as I moved into, okay, let's try this thing again. Let's eat properly again. And then you do it enough times that it becomes an unconscious action. I thought, I need to rebuild these unconscious actions in a new way, because the way I was doing it before didn't work because I almost died. So let's just rebuild it in a better way and just do the best that I can. And then, yeah, identity issues then became...
So can we get into them in a second, because that would be fascinating. It just sounds like... There's so much paradox in this because, or irony maybe, in that it's like you had to literally be on your ass in a cast, you know, with your whole world kind of like basically physically and almost mentally incapacitated before you stopped to actually consider what it means to be alive. And it sounds to me like you didn't step over that opportunity. Like you actually, you know, you went, okay, well, here I am. So would it be fair to say that, and you talk about what you enabled or allowed to go into your unconscious processes, so you became very conscious and deliberate. Like, how does that help you today? Like, how does that deliberate and consciousness help you in your day-to-day today?
I think firstly, learning to notice the little things, just really being grateful about little things. I remember the sensation of walking on grass and bare feet for the first time after being in hospital so long. That was just brilliant. Although I did feel like if I fell over, I felt like I was made of glass, my body was just going to break. But just that feeling, it was like, wow. I remember being as a kid noticing that feeling, you know, the smell of fresh cut grass. Man. Wow. The senses were really heightened again. It was really enjoyable. Being conscious about things takes a lot of effort, breaking things down. But as you're happy and deliberate and move that into an unconscious space, so it just becomes automatic. You get up, you have breakfast, but now you're having, you know, oats and nuts rather than half a bottle of scotch, then, you know, it kind of sets you up a bit better for your day. Doing exercise, making sure that you get a routine. And I think it was just setting up a new routine of life of unnegotiables. You know, I do exercise, I eat healthy, I share love and warmth with my wife and children, I spend time connecting with others and world around me. And these things are non-negotiable and I have to do them every day, every week. And then I can build everything else on top of that. But if these things go, if sleep starts falling off, then I have to pull back on everything else because otherwise I just can't exist properly in this world. Mm.
Wow, so isn't it great that, like, I mean, okay, you went through a fair bit of grief and hardship, but, you know, you've come to a place in, you know, comfortable middle age where you've got this life ahead of you where it's like you've got wisdom without old age, you know?
I think my wife would question that.
Well, yeah, oh, I've got one of them too. Don't worry. Yeah. No, but so coming back to that comment you made about identity, like, and how you had to reshape or reframe your identity. I'd love to sort of interrogate that a little bit. Like, you know, who were you? What did you go through? And who have you become? Or how do you frame identity these days?
Yeah, well, you know, you go through life and you shift. Well, in my case, I did anyway. I became an army officer and then I shifted my identity again when I went and worked in the financial services industry. Then I shifted it again post 9/11 when I went back and worked in the offshore crisis management emergency evacuation. Then I shifted it again when I went into education and started working as a CEO. So you do go through these identity shifts. Mm. But then you reflect on that and go, well, what's been the constant throughout? What has been that? Peeling back the values. What hold that together and what do I want to hold it together? In the end, I just thought, well, in this world, I'm just Ben. I'm just using my name. This is who I am. This is what I do. It was a bit weird when I stopped employment as a result of my injuries. Paid employment. So I no longer carry a business card. And it's really interesting when you go to networking functions and people ask you for, you know, what you do. And I think that's just an automated response. You know, who are you? What do you do? What's your name? What do you do? And it took me probably a good 18 months to work out how to answer what it is you do. And I'm still not even sure. You can't really say, oh, well, I do Ben.
not often anyway. Yeah.
And it's a freaking tough job. It's like 24/7. People are just looking for a connection, a way to contact, a way to connect with another person. So often take in the situation and we'll just find a way to connect with that person without just talking about what it is that you do. I mean, it might even flick it around and say, well, today I did some plumbing in the backyard, or today I went and spoke to a really interesting group of people at the War Memorial. And I try to bring it a lot back to the present.
Yeah.
And that allows for that connection to take place. And if they're actually really interested, then they'll go and say, well, do you work? And then we go down the whole, well, not for money, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I volunteer as an ambassador for different charities. But at the same time, I don't really like being constrained into one particular area. But I mean, running into people in life who you know, identify with me as a CEO, identify me as an army officer, identify with me as an artist, or God help those people, or identify with me as a sports person, you know, at Invictus Games. You go, oh no, you're the powerlifter, the indoor rower, the gold medalist, and that is part of the story, but it's not the whole story. And I really enjoyed doing that, but it doesn't define to me who I am. It was just another exploration and another, you know, extraordinary experience. And it's just part of gathering extraordinary experiences. So the identity is much bigger than a particular term. And that's why I just like say, oh, mm-hmm. You've just been. I'm just a bloke.
It's interesting.
I like to define it. I've got a bit more around my family too these days.
I can hear in some of your comments around identity that, particularly when you're in the present, so you know you're keeping the conversation local in the, you know, in the moment as opposed to stuck in the past. You're very playful around identity, like with people, and that enables that connection, as you described. So identity is a fickle beast. It's kind of, you know, you create it to serve you in any given moment, but you can kind of lay it down and choose something else that's going to be more empowering to help you do whatever it is that you need to do or connect with whoever it is you need to connect with. So you know, that's not common. Because I imagine, you know, you probably had a crisis of some sort of identity going into the realization you had PTSD. So when life was breaking down, you know, that must have been tough on your, you know, 20-somethings military identity that you'd created and projected to the world.
Yeah, that was really tough. I had convinced myself that I was essentially invincible. You know, I was a CEO, board director, ex-army officer, tall, strong.
Damn good looking.
Then I got diagnosed. Well, I try to tell as many people as I can. and then someone goes, I think you got PTSD. You go, well, hang on. That doesn't happen to me. Like, nah. Oh, and maybe you need to reach out to some of your friends and have to talk to them about it. I'm like, how can that happen? I'm the boss. Like, and my friends normally come to me when they need a hand, not the other way around. I mean, it sounds so very egotistical, and maybe I used ego as a way just to try to hold it all together. I'm not sure. But, yeah, I remember being like that and going, wow, this can't happen to me. All right, just tell me what I need to do, and there's no point talking to other people about it, because by the time I put that action plan into place, the issue will be resolved. I'll be over this mental health illness before we say boo. It didn't happen like that. In fact, quite the opposite. I was supposed to be at a major relaunching of our national base construction with the Governor General, all of our key stakeholders, board members, staff, broader community, and cutting the ribbon. And I didn't show up because I was in a hospital and had to put out a public announcement that, you know, I wasn't there. I was unwell. And that was really confronting. I felt like I'd dropped my pants in front of the world.
Mm.
And it was like, whoa, I am so vulnerable. I can't even talk. I couldn't even write my own letter. It was just so brutally exposed that, yeah, it shattered any preconceptions of ego and identity that I had. It just leveled me down really hard and really fast.
Mm. That ego can be a pretty persistent bugger. I imagine that I mean, this may not be the case, so I'm speculating, but, you know, once publicly diagnosed and, you know, in that, like, how much have you wrestled with your ego identity as Ben, you know, the PTSD, Ben, the, you know, ambassador around mental health? Like, how much has that kind of been a challenge for you to be playful with in this, instead of being too attached to?
Oh, look, I don't think I went out there with the intent of being an ambassador or talking about mental health or PTSD or the like. It wasn't something I sat down and thought about initially. It was just something that people just kept asking for.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Let me put a bit of a framework around this because I started getting really busy. I'm like, hey, hang on. I'm retired at home trying to look after myself and my family, being asked to do all these public events. And I was like, oh, okay, I need to put some structure around this. So I had to sit down with those close to me, my wife, my kids, my family, my psyche, and go, all right, what's happening in this space? And this is going back into that conscious approach. You know, what is going on here? What do we think is happening? And do I want to engage in that? Like, I've been getting these requests. Do I want to engage? After some discussion, I was like, well, do you feel good doing it? I'm like, yeah. I actually enjoy it as a means of connecting with the broader community. Are you doing good things with it? Yes. Could it be helping people? Well, I hope so. Is it a win-win? I was like, yeah. Well, let's just continue. Just see where it goes, and if it doesn't go anywhere, if it dries up overnight, then nothing ventured, you know, nothing lost.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh, well, just a bit of curiosity again. Well, let's not think too much about it then. Let's just take step by step down the path and go with it. And I don't know, different organisations, different people I talk to, each of them probably form their own perception of who I am and what part of my identity resonates with them. But I definitely don't try to go out there and say, look, I'm Ben the so-and-so guy, because to do that just cuts off so many other aspects, and because I'm not actually sure what that other thing is. I like the variety.
So, Ben, I'm kind of interested in your perspective around when you look back at who you were versus, you know, who, you know, to sort of wrap up this conversation around identity, like when you look back at who you were versus who you are today, do you have any kind of, you know, gentle perspective on that?
Yeah, I actually feel like hugging my old self, giving him a big hug.
Nice.
He was working really hard. He was trying to tick off all the measures of success in terms of, you know, paying off the mortgage, putting the kids through a good school, keeping a family together, working bloody hard, trying to support people, trying to do the right thing, and just driving himself into the earth, all with good intentions, but just falling apart. And I look back at that middle-aged version of myself that was driving for success, whatever it was, and say, so look, you know, you don't need to die or get close to that point in order to realise that life doesn't have to be like this, that there are different ways. It's not going to be an easy journey to transition across that bridge, but it is possible. And it's kind of funny because I think when I go and talk to audiences, especially when there's large groups of men who are my age, I think a lot of them understand what that feeling is like, or the pressures of working your ass off to pay off the mortgage, put money away for investments, get the kids through school while still trying to be the bloody guy who loves his wife and does stuff with kids' school projects and all the other expectations and, you know, they find it tough, and I think that resonates with a lot of guys. And at the end of it, it's usually those big bloody tradies and plumbers who come up and give you a hug and say, mate, I'm there right now, or I've been there, I know what that feels like. You know, I just want to hug them too. Yeah, it's human.
Wow. So it sounds like who you are today is really self-compassionate. So probably compassionate generally, but, you know, you bring a much greater sense of self-compassion to your lived experience longitudinally.
Yeah.
Then
everyone's just
again, you know, that sounds like wisdom.
Based on what they know. You know, and you just don't really know who's going through what they reveal. So you just got to have that compassion.
Ben, I've loved this chat, mate. I really appreciate you sharing all that you have. It's been, personally, I've found it just. I feel grounded and settled as a consequence of our chat, and I'm really grateful.
Yeah. Well, thoughts are with all the listeners out there, especially those in the investment industry at the moment, and in the finance. And hope they're all going well at this time. I'm not sure if there's any what my value add is out there. If there's something that'll be great. If not, keep going strong.
There's plenty of nuggets in this one, Ben, so thank you. Mate, if people want to reach out and say g'day, what's the best place for them to catch you?
Ben Farinazzo on LinkedIn. Probably the best place to find me would be just go to benfarinazzo.com. That's my website, and there's a contact sheet on there.
Great.
And that'll give some background as well.
Yeah, perfect. All right. Well, Ben, any last parting words? Anything else you want to leave with, or we can wrap it up?
Have a great day. So great to have this opportunity to use a podcast to connect with you again after 30-odd years, Dave. Thanks, mate.
Yeah, how about that? What a gift.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, good one.
Up to the
thing. All right. Well, thanks, Ben.
See you, Dave.
Cheers, mate. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ben. If you've had issues arise for you as a result of our conversation, please reach out to Lifeline on their crisis support line on 131114. That's it for today's episode of Beyond the Obvious. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a favourable rating or review in the App Store. If you'd like to get in touch, please reach out to me on LinkedIn. Until next time, hooray.